Welcome to the Birthful Podcast. I'm Adriana Lozada, and today we're going to be talking about birth hormones. Birth hormones are in charge of making your labor flow, of establishing breastfeeding, and helping you bond with your baby. Supporting your hormones can lead to a healthier and smoother birth for sure, so how can you encourage them, and what should you avoid? Dr. Sarah Buckley is here to tell us more. Stay tuned. This episode of Birthful is brought to you by Swanky Badger, allowing you to create the most meaningful, personalized gifts for the guys in your life that are also practical. Go to swankybadger.com/birthful to get 10% off your first purchase. This episode of Birthful is also brought to you by Molecule, the only air purifier that actually destroys pollutants instead of just collecting some of them on a filter. For $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com and enter the code Birthful at checkout. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents to inform your intuition. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Thank you for your messages, all the love you send, and for helping spread the word about this Birthful Podcast with your friends, care providers, doulas, your social media feeds, just, you know, sharing it with the world, really. I truly appreciate it. And if what you hear is helpful, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a thing. If you want to further support this podcast, you know, there's three ways. You can, one, support its sponsors, which in this week's case are Swanky Badger and Molecule. You can also support it by becoming an official Birthful patron when you join the Birthful community at patreon.com/birthful. You will receive my everlasting gratitude for joining us and helping me make this happen. And as a bonus, you'll also get access to ad-free episodes and the extra content that I create for each episode. So, for example, for this week's case, you're going to get access to a companion worksheet that I created for this episode, inspired by Dr. Buckley's suggestions on how to help your birth hormones flow. Find out more and join the Birthful community at patreon.com/birthful. And another lovely way to support this and help yourself get postpartum ready is by signing up for my Thrive With Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes at birthfulcourses.com. And the class can help you understand why babies do what they do, how to figure out the baby you got, and help you transition through the identity change of becoming a parent, as well as honoring your recovery and helping you come together with your partner as a team. Yeah, there's a lot to this class. Ideally, you want to start the class during the last months of pregnancy, so around 30 weeks, the 30-week mark or so, but you do get instant lifetime access to all the courses and all the materials immediately. So really, you can take it at whatever pace works for you. Go sign up at birthfulcourses.com. All right. For today's renewed episode, I'm bringing back my talk on birth hormones with the fabulous Dr. Sarah Buckley. And Sarah is a general practitioner and family physician, as well as an author of the best-selling book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering. Her work critiques pregnancy, birth, and parenting from the widest possible perspectives, including the scientific, anthropological, psychological, and the experiential. Sarah has been sharing her unique blend of science and wisdom with parents and birth professionals internationally since 2005. She's specially interested in the hormonal physiology of childbearing, and in January of 2015, she published an in-depth and groundbreaking report entitled Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing, Evidence and Implications for Women, Babies, and Maternity Care, which you can find at childbirthconnection.org. It is a fantastic read, and they've split it into different sections, so you don't have to like jump into the whole report, which is really long and in-depth. So hormones are key for understanding and supporting labor flow, and if you're pregnant, you need to hear all about it, which is why I'm renewing this vital conversation. I also love talking with Sarah because we both very much believe that people should be well-informed while listening to their intuition, and that we are each the true experts when it comes to our bodies, our babies, and our families. Oh, and you should also know that Sarah lives with her family on the semi-rural outskirts of Brisbane, Australia. So, all right, here we go. Here's the show. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks, Adrienne. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you here. So how are things in Australia? It's getting cold. a little bit?
Yes, we're just it's getting towards the winter, though it's not a very strong winter where I live in Brisbane. We're on the sort of halfway up on the east side of Australia, so subtropical, but beautiful in the winter, like but cool, clear, sunny, just the best time of year here.
Sounds lovely, lovely. So I gotta tell you, the report that you published, I was looking through it, and it is an impressive piece of work. There is so much in there, and so vital for people to know. So first, I wanted to thank you for doing all that work because I know it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, you're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then can you tell us, sort of summarize for us, what makes birth hormones so important?
Okay, well, that's a big question. And as you can see in the report, I've answered it in depth. So I just want to refer people to that. If you could put the link up with the podcast to Adriana, but you'll find it if you Google hormonal physiology. It's on the childbirthconnection.org website. So I really encourage people to go and have a look. And the report itself is very detailed, but there's also some shorter, like more parent-focused material there. There's a healthy birth pathway, and there's a great little booklet there that I recommend people grab and look at. And if you have some more in-depth questions along the sort of lines that we're talking today, then do download a copy. It's a free PDF. You can use the search function to find whatever topic you're interested in. So yeah, my interest in hormonal physiology, or the hormones of labor and birth, we could call it, really started with my own experiences giving birth. You know, I went through medical school and I attended births and hospital, and then when I worked as a GP, I attended some births at home as well. But my own experience of giving birth was quite different to what I'd learned at medical school or in my obstetric training, or diploma of obstetrics I have. So I was curious about that, you know, that gap really. What is it? How do you explain this ecstatic experiences that I have, overwhelmingly positive, and the enormous love and protectiveness that I felt for my baby the moment I saw my first baby in particular? You know, I'd planned to have her in a separate room and borrowed a bassinet from the neighbor. And once I laid eyes on her, once she'd been born, I didn't want her more than a meter away from me. And, you know, part of my interest has really been, well, what explains that? Like, how did that happen? That wasn't an intellectual process. Like, it wasn't something I decided. It was really something very physical that happened to me in that process. And what I discovered through looking at the hormonal physiology over, well, about 13 years now. So I first published a book, an article called Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor, in Mothering Magazine in 2002, and it was one of their most popular articles, really a great summary of this material. And if you go to my website, sarahbuckley.com, you can download that as a free ebook, Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor. And I've been in love with the hormones ever since. I've really written more and more in-depth information about them. So there's that, which is one version of it. There's also in my book, there's a chapter called Undisturbing Birth. In my book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering. And then the most in-depth, of course, is my report, which has taken me many years to write. I say the length of gestation is appropriate to the size of the baby. But it's really answering that question, how is birth designed to happen, and what is meant to happen in an evolutionary or biological, or we could say physiological sense for mothers and babies? And what I discovered is that, you know, the whole system of mammalian birth, you know, we're mammals, we have mammary glands. If you could see me, I'd be clutching my breasts right now to illustrate that point. We have mammary glands, we suckle our young, and you know, like all other mammals, you know, it's imperative that not just birth is safe, but that also breastfeeding is successful, or lactation, and that mother-baby attachment is successful. Because if you think about all of our foremothers giving birth in the wild, you know, there weren't any breast milk substitutes. If breastfeeding wasn't successful, the babies wouldn't survive. And similarly, if the mother wasn't rewarded and motivated to give that dedicated care that every mammalian mother gives to her newborn, and human mothers particularly, because we have such a long period of dependence with our babies, then our babies wouldn't survive. If we didn't respond to our babies crying, we didn't pick them up, if we left them to cry, if we put them somewhere else to sleep, they wouldn't survive. So we have these inbuilt innate systems of caretaking, of lactation, that are actually related to, as I discovered through this work, that are intrinsically related and switched on by the hormonal physiology of childbirth. So the report's called The Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing, because I'm talking not just about birth, but also about breastfeeding and attachment. And, you know, from an evolutionary or Mother Nature's perspective, or if you want to call it divine design, breastfeeding and attachment are just as important as surviving birth. So there's a lot of investment in these things, and the hormones that optimize survival at birth also optimize breastfeeding and attachment. And by the same token, if we mess up, if we disrupt those hormones of labor and birth, we can also disrupt breastfeeding and attachment. And that really is a bit of a story of modern maternity care. You can see in the report, I talk not just about the physiology, how the hormones are designed to work, but also what happens when we bring in various interventions like synthetic oxytocin, Pitocin, like induction, like epidurals, like cesareans. It really does disrupt the hormones for mothers and babies. And we haven't looked at that. There's not a lot of study on that, not a lot of in-depth research, because from a medical perspective, we've viewed breastfeeding and attachment as like soft outcomes, and we haven't even been interested in them. I mean, for example, at the moment, there's two major studies of randomizing women to induction or not, and neither of them are measuring breastfeeding as an outcome. So we have quite a big gap really between the hormonal physiology and what we do and how we care for women and how we what we prioritize in the processes of labor and birth. And you know, another overall message really is that all of these hormones we're talking about have very positive effects on our brain and our psyche. They switch on instinctive mothering behaviors, but they also activate their reward centers. So from that perspective, birth is really designed to be a rewarding and pleasurable experience, that the mother comes out of it feeling really attached and rewarded for caretaking her babies, and maybe even saying, you know, that was great, I want to do this again. And you know, that means that we have lots of babies, and again, that contributes to the survival of our species. So The report has a lot of like evolutionary backgrounds, a lot of physiology, and a lot of common sense from my perspective.
Yeah, and it makes sense. For example, I was talking to Diane Wiesinger, and her thing is, what do mammals do? And in to speak to your point, she talks about, if we're looking at other mammals and dogs and horse breeding, until breastfeeding gets initiated, the vets are very worried, because until that happens, the birth is not over. So it's not over until breastfeeding gets going.
That's exactly right. And I've co-presented online with Diane. And she also says that, you know, in a zoo, like if you're a zookeeper, you know that the baby's going to survive. When the mother gets that fiercely protective, you know, she'd scratch you or bite you if you tried to take the baby away. So that's another critical part of, you know, that's attachment, that's biological bonding, as I call it in the report. That's what we're designed to do actually as well. We're designed to have that fiercely protective instinct towards our babies that would have us, you know, hold our babies close and, you know, and be rewarded for the interactions that we have with our babies.
Mm-hmm. So if we take these hormones and break it down to the different parts of birth, say, if we're looking at late pregnancy, how do these hormones help you prepare, and how do they affect the birth that is coming?
Yeah, great question. So just to go back to the report, so if you're going to follow up what I'm saying for more detail in the report. Every report, there's four chapters that go through these hormones we're talking about, and every chapter looks at the hormone, like the big picture of the hormone outside reproduction, then looks at the hormone in pregnancy, including late pregnancy, then looks at the hormone in labor and birth, and looks at the hormone postpartum. So it's really easily laid out for you to look through and verify what I'm saying here. So basically, you know, these things are critical. We've just established that breastfeeding and attachment are critical. So those processes have to kick in for an animal in the wild straight after birth. So, you know, mice and dogs and cats and lions, they don't go to prenatal classes. They've got to straight away, you know, enact these things. And for example, with mice, if you present a pregnant mouse with a little baby, she'll actually cannibalize that baby because her hormones haven't kicked in. But straight away after birth, if you present her with a baby, she'll take tender care of that baby. So these changes happen in the lead up to labor and it also during labor. So in the lead up to labor, the hormone systems are getting prepared for this enormous transition of labor and birth, and also for, as I mentioned, breastfeeding and attachment. So the systems are getting what we say upregulated, like getting brought on board, you could say, brought online. And part of that involves increases for most of the hormones in the hormone itself, but particularly shifts in the hormone receptors. I'm just going to go back a step and explain what I mean by that. So a hormone technically is a substance that's produced in one part of the body and it has effects in another part of the body. And the way it has effects is it binds with what's called a hormone receptor. And that's specific to that hormone. It's a bit like a key going into a lock. It's a specific key for a specific specific lock. And when the hormone binds with that receptor, which is, as I said, like a keyhole on the outside of a cell, it sends a chemical message into the cell. For example, people who are listening may have heard of the hormone oxytocin, which causes the rhythmic contractions of labor. So that's released from the brain, and it travels through the body. It goes to the woman's uterus, the laboring woman's uterus. It finds those receptors on the outside of the myometrial cells, the uterine muscle cells. It fits into that lock, turns the key, the message goes into the cell saying contract. Now, the amount of hormones increases, as we said, even before labor begins. But importantly, the number of receptors increases. Receptor numbers can go up and down, just like hormone numbers can go up and down. So the body basically prepares itself to be optimally ready at the most sensitive possible situation at the onset of labor and birth, which means not just the uterus being sensitive, which means, from what we've discussed, a lot of oxytocin receptors, but also the brain, because that's where all this attachment is going to be happening. And the hormones that we're talking about also have like effects within the brain. For example, oxytocin, we just discussed, has psycho-emotional effects. It actually helps us to feel calm, connected. It's been called the hormone of love. You may have heard of that.
Yes.
And it also has intrinsic pain-relieving effects. So it's very useful. You know, it makes sense that the body would have all these things ready to go at the physiologic onset of labor. So oxytocin in the brain for attachment systems, and the uterus for effective contractions. And other animals, receptor numbers also increase in the breasts. We can't do, no one's put up their hand to have that done in themselves. No. Pregnant women have said, oh, yes, you can come and biopsy my breast for oxytocin receptors. So we don't know, you know, concretely about women, but we'd have to guess it's going to be the same. And the other hormones, it's similar. So prolactin, which is a major hormone of breast milk synthesis, also a hormone of bonding and attachment. It levels increase in the brain in animals, and in the mammary glands and the breasts in animals as well. For the baby, there's this, of course, you know, this critical transition to life outside the womb. The baby's got to start to begin doing things it's never done before. It really is just miraculous when you start to think about what's happening for the baby. So, of course, the baby's going to have all those systems, you know, ready to go at the onset of labor. And particularly for the baby, the hormones, adrenaline, noradrenaline, or epinephrine, norepinephrine, as we call them in the report. So what happens is, as the baby goes through labor, their epinephrine, norepinephrine levels increase, and towards the end they get what's called a catecholamine surge. That's the collective name for these hormones, and that helps to protect them from the long, strong, close together contractions of labor. And it also prepares their bodies for this enormous transition. It optimizes the lung function, because of course the first thing the baby has to do when they're born is breathe. So it clears the fluid out of the lungs, it dilates up the airways, and increases the lung surfactant, which is a lung lubricant, and other effects. So those effects happen at the end of labor through the catecholamine surge, or epinephrine, norepinephrine for the baby, really critical for the baby's well-being. So, of course, that system is going to be online before the onset of labor. So the baby gets increased receptor numbers, so that these hormones, when they come in late labor, are really going to be maximally effective. And listeners may know that sometimes babies born by cesareans have specific difficulties in making that transition, and particularly they have difficulties with the breathing system. Babies are several times more likely to require help with breathing after a cesarean, because they haven't had not only the catecholamine surge of labor, but they haven't had that opportunity to really optimize and sensitize their system to those hormones beforehand. So for mother and baby, there's this, I mean, that's just what we know about. You know, when you read through the report, you can see that there's huge gaps as well. There's so much that we don't know. But as far as we know, you know, we can say that there's these amazing preparations that mothers and babies make so that the chance of succeeding, the chance of surviving labor and birth, and of successful breastfeeding and attachment is optimized. So that's chapter 2 in the report. It's called The Physiologic Onset of Labor Versus Scheduled Birth, and it goes through all those changes in a lot of detail.
Fantastic. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I have a question about the catecholamines in baby. We'll be right back. With Father's Day just around the corner, you probably have some shopping to do. And let's face it, shopping for guys is not usually an easy thing. So if you haven't already found that perfect gift, you should check out swankybadger.com. Father's Day is all about showing Dad how much he's loved and appreciated, and a personalized gift from Swanky Badger can really help you with that. The gifts at Swanky Badger are super practical with something for everyone. They've got wallets, phone cases, watches, whiskey decanters, and a lot more. But the truly fabulous thing I find is how personal and sentimental you can make any of those gifts. My daughter and I gave it a try, and we had the best time ordering gifts for Father's Day. We decided to get a phone case and a flask, and Annika was truly giddy when she found out that she could customize them. Ah, the power that is generated when you let your teenage daughter engrave her dad's phone case. Her messages are definitely not sappy ones, but they are meaningful and will make her dad smile every time he sees them, which is the point, right? So for the phone case, she chose to write, "Sometimes you're a lot," which is something they say to each other all the time. And I'm not going to tell you right now what she chose to put on that flask. The process of getting these Swanky Badger gifts was super easy, and we were happily surprised that the phone cases were vegan, since my husband is vegan and never wears leather. Our order arrived quickly, and the items are good quality, and as the name says, they look quite swanky. But really, what makes a gift from Swanky Badger stand apart is that ability to add a meaningful or sentimental message. And you wouldn't believe how powerful these messages can be. If you go to swankybadger.com, there's a video of several dads opening their gifts and literally breaking down in tears at how much these messages and gifts mean to them. It's amazing. You've got to go check it out. I can see this being a particularly great gift if this is their first Father's Day ever, whether they're a new dad or a dad-to-be. You can create your own personalized Father's Day gift today by going to swankybadger.com/birthful, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase. So swankybadger.com/birthful, and make sure to check out that video of all the guys crying. Honestly, it's one of the sweetest things you'll ever see. swankybadger.com/birthful for 10% off. And we're back. Okay, so you were talking about the catecholamines in the baby. Mm. And is that, as babies coming out through the birth canal, does that help balance out that sometimes just by being squeezed and just the tight fit, the oxygen might be, if the cord's getting squeezed, that the oxygen levels might be a bit low? And does that help the baby sort of be okay with that?
Yeah. Yeah, good question, Adriana. Because, you know, what happens, it's not just as the baby comes out to be born. As you say, that's an oxygen stress for the baby. But all the time during labor, you know, the mother's uterus is squeezing. And inevitably, this is birth among placental mammals. This is what happens for all of us. So her uterus squeezes the baby's placenta. And if it squeezes hard enough, it's going to shut off blood supply to the baby to some extent. So every mammalian baby has this problem during labor of hypoxia, of low oxygen levels. And mammalian babies are superbly adapted through, as I talk about, millions of years of evolution, or if you like, divine design, to adapt to this hypoxia. And of course, the organ that's most vulnerable, that we protect the most, is the brain. So there's a lot of neuroprotective effects of these hormones and of other systems that help the baby to survive and to thrive during those low oxygen levels. You know, if we as adults had such low oxygen levels as babies, we wouldn't survive. But babies have these amazing, miraculous adaptations. And as you say, one of those adaptations is this catecholamine surge. I mean, it has firstly a directive neuroprotective effect. It helps the brain cells to survive low oxygen levels. But it also has the effect of shifting the blood supply. So when the baby has this catecholamine surge, the blood supply shifted preferentially to the brain and the heart, which is the two most vital organs, and shifted away from the non-essential organs. So that's a neuroprotective effect. Other hormones also have neuroprotective effects. We haven't talked about beta endorphins, which you probably know as endorphins, as a natural pain relief for the mother, but they also increase in the baby during labor. You know, it's a stressful event for the baby, and these are stress hormones to some extent. And when those beta endorphins get to a certain level, they also have a neuroprotective effect. And oxytocin, you can also look this up in the report. There's quite a complex neuroprotective effect that involves the mother's oxytocin going through to the baby and turning down activity in the baby's brain. This is among other mammals. We haven't been able, as I said, we haven't able to test this in humans because we haven't sampled any baby's brains, but we know that the mother's oxygen goes to the baby's brain, and switches down or switches off the baby's brain activity. So the baby's sort of, you could say, a bit asleep in labor. And if the baby's a bit asleep, the brain's not working much in the brains. It cuts down the brain's requirement for oxygen and glucose, which is, you know, when the blood supply is in short measure, the fuel glucose is going to be a bit in short supply for the baby as well. So there's all these neuroprotective factors. I've just named a few of them, but there's other ones as well. And there's surely many more that we don't know about because, you know, it's designed to work. This whole thing is designed to work and really have the baby survive and thrive and make this transition successfully.
Mm-hmm. And I know we've been jumping around parts of labor and before labor and after labor as we were talking, but so I'm going to keep jumping around. We often hear that it's baby that triggers the onset of labor to say, I am ready to be born, let's get this process started. Sort of like, I am cooked and ready and can want to come out. What truth is that? What truth is there to that hormonally?
So there is this whole chapter again. I refer you to physiologic onset of labor. So the first thing to say is, if I could tell you what triggered the onset of human labor, I would get a Nobel Prize because we actually don't know, which is kind of ironic when we're meddling with it to such a large extent. You know, so many women are having induction or having a pre-labor cesarean, which means they don't experience the physiologic onset of labor and all those things we just talked about: the baby being at optimal readiness, the mother being at optimal readiness. So as far as we know, yes, it is the baby that triggers the onset of labor, although exactly what the trigger is. Is there one trigger? Is it several things that come together to trigger the onset of human labor? We don't really know that. But yes, there's all these preparations happening in the baby, particularly cortisol is another stress hormone, but that's also involved in preparing the baby and maturing the baby's organs. And it's basically there's signals. So the placenta is, you could say, the bridge or the conduit between mother and baby. And there's common hormonal processes happening. There's metabolism and production of hormones within the placenta. So via the placenta, the mother and the baby's systems are coordinating, are passing signals back and forth around that readiness. So as the baby's getting ready and cortisol is being made, in the mother, in parallel, the mother's making estrogen. And what estrogen does is it upregulates or increases the oxytocin system. So it creates more oxytocin receptors. It also helps with prostaglandins and other, you know, anatomical, physiological aspects of readiness for labor. So it is the baby that signals it, and it's through actually maturation of the baby's adrenal gland, which provides the precursors, the substances that all these hormones are made from. So that's all I can say about it. As I said, there's, you know, you can imagine the billions of dollars of research being put into this because, of course, prematurity is such a major problem and a major cause for morbidity, you know, for sickness and death among newborn babies. So anything that we could do to prevent prematurity would be a great contribution. But really, our understanding is really still very basic, and we don't understand what it is that actually triggers, what the final trigger is that flips women into labor.
So in that same vein, talk to us a little bit, and thank you for, it's still the baby, but we don't know exactly well or how.
Yeah,
but it is
right.
The baby. Baby's ready.
It well, yeah.
tying to that, let's talk about inductions, because there are so many inductions happening and they're on the rise. And how does that affect that hormonal flow, aside from just increasing the chance of prematurity because you don't know exactly how ready baby is to be born?
Well, the most scientific answer to your question, Adrienne, is we don't know, because really we haven't studied these processes exactly in induction. We haven't studied these processes much at all. And as I said, that's ironic given, you know, the increasing and you know, really very high levels of induction. In the Listening to Mother surveys, about 33%, I can't remember, 30-something percent of women said they were medically induced. 50% of women, or actually more than 50% of women, said someone had tried to cause labor to start. So we really have this idea that we can interfere with that, that it doesn't make any difference. If we're this particular number, 40 weeks or 41 weeks or 39 weeks, then we can just, you know, trigger the onset of labor and everything will be okay. But from a hormonal physiology perspective, it really is a very major intervention. attention. So all of these things we've just talked about, so the mother's readiness, those receptors we're talking about, as we've ascertained in animal studies, and her brain and her breasts for oxytocin and prolactin, which are going to optimize attachment systems after birth, are going to optimize breastfeeding after birth. I mean, those are going to be interfered with. There's also preparation. We talked a little bit about beta endorphins being the one of the pain relieving systems for the mother, and those pain relieving systems get upregulated or brought online before labor and birth. So again, with induction, is the mother going to miss some of those intrinsic pain relieving effects? As for the baby's going to miss out on some of those, the catecholamine system, because the receptor numbers will be lower. And a whole lot of other physiological things outside of these four hormones as well. So it really is a major disruption to hormonal physiology, and we haven't begun to look at it. I mentioned the induction studies, all the studies that don't even measure breastfeeding as an outcome, which again is ironic when we know how important it is. And there's all this investment, you know, from breastfeeding professionals and breastfeeding lobbyists to promote breastfeeding, yet we haven't put that together with birth, that the beginning of breastfeeding actually happens through labor and birth. So, you know, there's a little bit of evidence. There's a handful of studies looking at induction and breastfeeding with some detrimental effects, but we don't have any really good research on that. We would guess that that would be impacted. And as far as attachment and bonding goes, well, there's almost no research on that at all. And you know, I included that in the report because I think it's really important. It's really important not just at the time. You know, it's Mother Nature's best shot at survival by making mothers and babies fall in love with each other and be like glued to each other. Some of you listening may remember that feeling. But it also, and this is, you know, this is, there's some evidence for this, but I also believe that from the research that I did, and I don't have direct evidence for this, is that I think that when the attachment systems are optimized and triggered at birth, it has a long-term effect, and the mother will ongoingly find her baby rewarding, because of course attachment isn't just about what happens on the first day, but it has to happen for the period of dependency among mammals. So, you know, it has to be there rewarding the mother for contact with her baby. And there was one study, this is the only study I could find in humans, that looked at mothers who'd had a fairly physiological birth, you know, induction, no epidurals, compared with mothers who'd had a pre-labor cesarean. And they wheeled these mothers into an MRI machine to look at the activity in their brain, and they played them the sound of their baby crying and to see what would happen in their brain. Obviously, in an MRI machine, you can't actually take your baby in there, but this was a proxy. So what they found was when the mothers had been through a physiologic labor and birth, the alertness centers of their brain lit up, the empathy centers and the reward centers. And that didn't happen in the same way for the mothers who'd been through a pre-labor cesarean. This was 2 to 4 weeks after giving birth. So we could conclude from that that there may be, or, you know, this was really consistent with my hypothesis that those hormonal peaks of labor and birth, these authors of the study actually highlight oxytocin, but all of the hormones that I describe peak in labor and birth and also are all involved with attachment and bonding. So, you know, missing out on those peaks has, you know, a short-term effect in humans, we could say from that study, but we don't know how long that effect lasts for. You know, that may be an ongoing effect. It may last till the teenage years, you know. It's kind of helpful if you still find your children rewarding in the teenage years. You know, you've built up, it's like the first impressions count, and Mother Nature designs this ideal situation for what Moshe Lodon calls the beginning of a great love affair, you know. And when we get that structured within the brain, it's happening within the brain, it's an emotional thing, it's in the emotional part of the brain, the limbic system, and when that's put into place, then you know, that's a factor for species survival. You know, there's another animal study, they had mother rats between 2 and 10 days postpartum, which is that most dependent time, and they offered them a choice between cocaine and contact with their babies, and cocaine is a powerfully rewarding substance, yeah, addictive, and all the mothers chose the babies were more rewarding than the cocaine at that time. And not only that, but they were also given the opportunity in another study to press a bar, and all baby came down the chute, and the mother rats would bar press until they had 20 babies in the cage. That was their limit. They had to take one baby out that bar press for another one. So rats would count to 20, you could say, but, you know, that's really how rewarding babies are for rats. And, you know, given that humans, we're in the same situation, but even more so because of this prolonged period of dependency, I would say that the switching on of the reward systems with physiologic labor and birth is even more important for us, and even more, you know, and likely to get railroaded by, you know, missing some of those pre-labor preparations, and especially pre-labor cesarean, because not only do you miss the preparations, but you miss the in-labor processes as well, those peaks of oxytocin and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we would press the bar for 20 babies coming down the chute, but definitely one. It's the reward. So yeah. Let's take a break and we'll come back to talk more about how we can make those hormones flow. We'll be right back. As if having a stuffy nose from being pregnant wasn't enough, here comes allergy season. You may think that your HEPA air filter is doing a great job of getting rid of the pollutants in your home air to help you breathe better, but the truth is that HEPA filters use air purification technology which is problematically outdated, letting super small pollutants like mold, viruses, bacteria, and volatile organic chemicals, or VOCs, slip right through. If you really want clean air in your house, you need a molecule air purifier that doesn't just collect air pollutants, but actually destroys them on a molecular level. Using breakthrough photoelectrochemical oxidation, PECO for short, developed over 20 years by the director of the Clean Energy Research Center at the University of South Florida, Molecule's patented dual filtration system and proprietary technology can break down a pollutant to its basic harmless components. So when you turn on your Molecule, you're creating the purest air possible. Now, Molecule's technology has been personally effective and verified by science, but most importantly, it's been tested by real people. Molecule has given allergy and asthma sufferers around the country an all new experience. Since Molecule launched, they've heard hundreds of stories from parents, pet lovers, and severe allergy and asthma sufferers about how Molecule has transformed their lives. One customer even said she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. Also, Molecule customers that use their Molecule air purifier in their bedrooms have reported feeling energized after getting the best night of sleep they've had in years, because breathing clean air can help you sleep better. And that can be quite important if you're at a stage of life when you are already not getting the greatest sleep, like, say, when you're pregnant or have a newborn. So go check it out. For $75 off your first order, visit MOLEKULE.com, so molecule.com, and at checkout, enter the code BIRTHFUL. That's molecule.com, and use the code BIRTHFUL on checkout for $75 off your first order. And we are back talking with Sarah Buckley about flowing with your birth hormones. So, Sarah, how can a laboring person help their hormones flow and really support this process?
Well, the thing is, it's a bit like sex, really. And these hormones are actually almost exactly the same hormones involved with making a baby. So in sex, it's not so much about doing things. It's more about not doing things. It's about setting up a good situation and not being disturbed. You know, if you want to have an orgasm, you don't have to invite lots of people into the room, right? So similarly, the processes of labor and birth, and that the peaks of hormones that happen with the birth are actually this parallel to the peaks of hormones that happen with orgasm, and whether a woman actually experiences, you know, feels like she's having an orgasm, which is certainly possible. Women do report that, and you can see my friend Deborah Pascali-Bonaro's film Orgasmic Birth and her beautiful works. Certainly is a physical possibility, but even if it doesn't feel like you're having an orgasm, the peaks of hormones are very similar to orgasms. So, you know, the sort of conditions that we need to have an orgasm and to have physiologic spontaneous birth are really very similar. So I say that the core requirements for birth among all mammals is that the laboring female feels private, safe, and unobserved. So it's really about not doing things. It's about preparing a situation and, you know, having the people there that support you, that aren't going to interfere, that you feel safe with, feeling safe at this very primal level, this limbic system level. It's part of the brain. And, you know, like any mammal giving birth, they look around for the safest place where there's no possibility of disturbance, where there's no one there they don't know. You know, and we do this thing to laboring when we don't actually think about that physiology, and we put women into the situation where they're having strangers all the time in a strange place with beeping noises. And, you know, that really doesn't encourage the activity in the limbic system and all of this hormonal flow. So going into physiologic labor and birth, as we just talked about, helps women to have all those preparations. having being private, safe, and unobserved in labor, and having the people there that can protect that space. Particularly, we talked a little bit before the interview about doulas and how important doulas are. We know that having a doula does increase your chance of physiologic birth. The studies have been done. Having your own midwife increases the chance of physiologic birth. Choosing a model of care, a low technology model of care, is going to be much kinder to your limbic system. Yeah, so that's much more likely that things will unfold. And the other point after the birth, you know, sometimes I haven't talked about it much here, but in the report and in my other work, I talk a lot about the hour after birth. And you know, all these systems are online. The mother's had these peaks of labor and birth. And so what I say is, you know, at birth, the mother graduates as a mother, and the hour after birth is a postgraduate education. So you have all these extreme levels of birth hormones that are designed to have you fall in love with your baby. So you're in this absolutely perfect state to fall in love with your baby, and similarly your baby as well. So that precious hour after birth, being skin to skin, eye to eye, no interruption in that hour after birth, is also really critical. And I just want to add something else in there, because you know that's an ideal, and you know I'd say 90% of women, you know, that could happen for, because you know our physiology works if we get out of the way. But sometimes things don't go according to plan. Sometimes there really is a need for some help. Sometimes a pre-labor cesarean is the safest thing for mothers and babies. So what we say in the report is, the more physiology you can add, how can you add more physiology? It's not, you know, physiologic childbearing and everything's wonderful over here like I just described and everything else on the other side. It's really, how can we move mothers and babies along this physiologic continuum? So, you know, one of the things I just described, if you do need a pre-labor cesarean, for example, you can add more physiology by really focusing on that skin-to-skin contact between you and your baby. And that will turn on some of these hormone systems that we talked about. It turns on oxytocin, endorphins, prolactin will get turned on through skin-to-skin, and suckling as well. And I'll just share an anecdote about that. It was a mother who'd had two previous natural births, physiologic births, and one that this baby, she needed a pre-labor cesarean. So she said, when I got my baby after the birth, my baby felt really different to my other babies. It was in a different physiologic state. What we've just described, the baby hasn't been through all these hormone processes of labor and birth, hasn't had the catecholamine surge, hasn't had the oxytocin peak or the endorphins peak that babies get as well. So the baby felt different. She said, my instinct was to just hold my baby skin to skin. And she said, after 3 days of skin to skin with my baby felt like my other babies did. So the other take-home message out of that is that, you know, that these processes of labor and birth are very extremely efficient, you know, through those hours or maybe very short duration of labor and birth, all of these things get switched on and it just works. But if you miss that, you can catch up, but it's not as effective. It's not as an efficient process because you're not in that peak readiness for the whole processes. So, you know, skin to skin, skin to skin, skin to skin is my guideline, you know, when you miss out on these hormones.
Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you saying that, because I spoke to Karen Strange also about the baby's birth experience, and she said the same thing. We are very, as a species, we're very resilient. And it doesn't mean that if for some reason you can't have a completely cascade flow of all these hormones and the intertwined dance at the moment of birth and right after, that doesn't mean game's over, that you can, but it does require a different level of mindfulness to have that happen.
That's right. That's right. And focusing on that physiology. And, you know, breastfeeding is also, sometimes I call it Mother Nature's backup system. When we breastfeed, we release all of those, those hormones, oxytocin, beta endorphins, prolactin, for mother and for baby. So breastfeeding is also part of that catch-up system where you're going to get, you know, continual exposure to these hormones. So what's missing is that peak readiness that happens in labor and birth, but we can gradually get those, this is my interpretation of the research that I read. We can gradually get those systems activated, but it takes a lot more work. Yeah, what would happen normally during labor and birth is so effective and efficient in a very short duration. If we want to catch up on that, we're going to have to be more dedicated. You know, we have to do more of it for longer, basically, to mimic those hormonal elevations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this next question is a completely selfish question, because it's something that's been something I've wondered a lot about and have heard different things throughout my experience as a doula and all the other things that I do maternity related. And it's comparing oxytocin with Pitocin, so the synthetic oxytocin and Pitocin, and its effects on a mom's body and how those compare, because I have heard doctors say they're exactly the same. They're identical. They do the same thing. But when a mom, I can see the difference when there's a labor with Pitocin, we call it here, or without it, that the labor itself, and that they, when they relate it, they say this is different, especially a mom who has had the experience with oxytocin and with Pitocin and without it, they say that's not, they weren't the same. Contractions weren't the same. So what does your evidence say on that?
Well, what do you notice yourself about women in that situation? I'm curious to know, like, do you notice something different? What do you think?
What do I notice and what they relate to me is that yeah. with Pitocin, things are a lot less manageable and they feel a lot more intense. And even in situations where they've had part of labor with it and then part of labor without it, even with, say, in transition or you know, have had a said lead up to it with Pitocin and suddenly it was too much and the Pitocin's been turned off. Yeah, and then, which wears out really quickly. And then their own body and natural processes take over. So they, at the same, sort of at the same peak of, say, transition, they had both experiences with the with the Pitocin and with the oxytocin. And they afterwards do compare it to me and say, those did not feel the same. One I could manage, the other I couldn't. So, but that is anecdotal. I'd love to know your take on it.
Well, it's interesting because I just posted this on Facebook this morning. So yeah, go into my report and look at page 57, and there's actually a table there called Table 2. It's called Established and Biologically Plausible Impacts of Physiologic versus Synthetic Oxytocin in Labor and Birth. So it's got all the information in there. But basically, we've got to look at the basic physiology versus pharmacology, because when we release oxytocin in labor, we release it from the brain, as I described, it goes through the body and binds with the receptors and causes these rhythmic uterine contractions. But at the same time, it's released within the brain. So it has some of the effects we talked about, the pain relieving effect, the calming connection effect, the falling in love effect. They're all central. They're all brain effects. So if you, for natural oxytocin at the same time that it's causing these contractions of labor, it's switching on all these things within the brain. The problem with one of the problems with synthetic oxytocin, Pitocin, is that we inject it into the body and it can't cross in significant amounts the blood-brain barrier. So it doesn't have those central effects. So that's part of what your women are describing, that they're not getting those pain-relieving effects that goes with natural oxytocin, those calm, connecting, loving effects that you naturally get during the release of it during labor and birth. It's also switching on those parts of the brain for breastfeeding and attachment. There's a number of other things. We talked about the neuroprotective effect that comes from the mother's oxytocin going through to the baby. So synthetic oxytocin in these animal studies did have that effect to some extent, but if you gave about 10 times more than physiologic doses, it turned off that effect. So the baby's, you know, high dose of synthetic oxytocin, if we were translating that to humans, could make human babies' brains more vulnerable. We can't say that categorically because we really don't know. We haven't done those studies in humans, kind of hard to do. Mm-hmm. Other differences is that the oxytocin that we release ourselves is released in pulses. So what happens is, just got to explain a little bit of physiology here. So our bodies are really smart. You might have gathered that. Our bodies are really smart. So what we do is we protect ourselves from overexposure to hormonal systems. So if we are exposed to constant high levels of hormones, our body decreases its sensitivity by decreasing receptor numbers. It's called receptor desensitization. And that happens, you know, and that happens in labor and birth as well. And the normal release of oxytocin from the brain in pulses, if I was standing in front of you, I'd be sort of making waves with my hand, because what that means is
I can
is
feel
that
them reaching me.
The mother's uterus is being exposed to oxytocin in a big peak, and then it comes down again, and a big peak, and it comes down again. And it also comes down quickly because her placenta is making a lot of enzyme to break it down. So the exposure of the woman's uterus to natural oxytocin is episodic, up and down in pulses. However, when we give synthetic oxytocin, we give it in this constant dose, and this high constant constant levels trigger desensitization, receptor desensitization. We know that happens in humans. Women's uteruses become less responsive to it. And we know, for example, if you've had exposure to synthetic oxytocin in labor, your chance of bleeding after birth is high because that's an oxytocin effect that gives you effective contractions to reduce the chance of bleeding. So receptor desensitization happens with synthetic oxytocin, but it doesn't happen with natural oxytocin. Also, synthetic natural oxytocin, you know, the levels increase towards the end of labor. And it's also involved in physiologic feedback systems. So what happens, what we think happens, is that as the mother experiences these labor contractions, the sensations are transmitted from nerves up to her brain, and the sensations trigger the onset of more oxytocin through her brain circuit. So the more oxytocin she releases, that goes down to her uterus, you get stronger contractions, there's more sensation of strong contractions, there's more triggering of the brain system. So it's a positive feedback system that has, as contractions get stronger, they get stronger. I describe labor a bit like a snowball effect. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger through these positive feedback loops. So it can actually, you know, increase the release of central oxytocin. And as far as we know, synthetic oxytocin doesn't do that, although increasing strength of contractions might do that. So there's many ways in which it has quite different effects on the body of the mother and the baby. The other problem is that we talked about the lead up to the onset of labor and the mother's receptor numbers becoming higher. So, of course, what happens at the physiologic onset of labor, she starts off, her receptor numbers are sensitive with a little bit of oxytocin, she gets more and more, and labor gets stronger and stronger. But when a woman's given this drug in labor, particularly for induction, we don't know how many receptors she's got. And some women bowl up for induction and they get this little drizzle of synthetic oxytocin and everything happens because they've got these large number of receptors. They probably would have gone into labor tomorrow. And yes. Some women, you can pour bucket loads in and nothing happens because they're not ready for it. Their receptors aren't there, and they probably would have naturally gone into labor in a week or, you know, 2 weeks. Who knows? You know, we don't know that. We can't predict the onset of labor in women. So yeah, many.
That would
many
be a noble, another Nobel Prize.
That would, it would, yeah. Yeah. So look at the table on page 57. You can see what I've said and the references to that and a lot more as well. But yeah, quite different experiences for the body, exactly as your women are describing.
Yeah, that does not. I mean, it, so would you say it that natural oxytocin acts both as a hormone and a neurotransmitter, whereas
yes.
The pitocin just acts as a hormone and even might block those receptors?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And we don't know what happens to the receptors in the breast, for example. And what you're saying acts as a neurotransmitter. Specifically, it's actually called a neuromodulator because it doesn't just have effects there and then on the brain. It also has ongoing effects. It actually reorganizes some of the neurohormonal systems. One example of that is from a study in women. They did this study on women and they checked their stress, their susceptibility to stress at 6 months, according to whether they'd ever breastfed, even just for a short time, or whether they've never breastfed. And the women that had ever breastfed had lower responses to stress at 6 months than women who had never breastfed. And you know, that really fits in with the exposure to oxytocin with breastfeeding has actually shifted or shaped, you could say, their neurohormones, their brain responses to stress, to get that positive 6 months later, to get an ongoing benefit of reduced stress susceptibility. So oxytocin reorganizes the systems a little bit, like I was saying, how the attachment systems get switched on at labor and birth ongoingly. You know, there's been a rearrangement and the brain is switching on of the maternal circuits, we could describe it as. So that's something that happens with central, you know, our own release of oxytocin, but not with synthetic oxytocin. I just want to say one more thing, which is that we used to think, you know, that if you give synthetic oxytocin, you're going to shut down the woman's own production. And we think that probably is not true. We don't know for sure because if we measure oxytocin in laboring women, we can't distinguish it. It's exactly the same molecule, our own oxytocin and pitocin. So we can't distinguish them. But what happens, that positive feedback loop we were talking about where stronger contractions lead to the central release of oxytocin. So synthetic oxytocin can trigger that effect if the woman's body is ready enough. So if you cause these strong contractions through synthetic oxytocin, that can signal her own central release of oxytocin. It's a complicated area because there is another study that measured the amount of oxytocin released by women during breastfeeding 2 days after birth. And for those women, the more oxytocin they received in labor, the lower their own release was 2 days after birth, and we can't explain that. We don't think there's a negative feedback loop in labor, but we don't really know.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating to me. I mean,
it's fascinating.
Obviously fascinating to you, yes. And I'm so glad you mentioned stress, because stress can be, it's like the crux of it all at all stages of the process.
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, I go back to, you know, evolutionary principles that for, you know, mammalian mothers giving birth in the wild, it's critical that they're in the least stressful situation possible, that they know that they're safe to have their baby, because, you know, labor and birth, it's kind of hard to respond to a danger or a predator. You know, you can't run very fast and you can't really, you know, fight or flight doesn't work that well. So there's a whole lot of processes. I mean, there's a whole lot of processes that inhibit labor if the mother's in a stressful situation. And the limbic system, this primitive part of the brain, doesn't distinguish between, you know, there's a line on the horizon and, you know, the machines are beeping. You know, that's a stress to the limbic system as well. So, as I said before, if we were taking women's, if we're taking physiology, you know, real physiology into account, we would provide the lowest stress situation for laboring women. And if you think about how traditional systems of maternity care, you know, look after women culturally, is they really look after women's emotional well-being in labor. And I think that's the benefits of doulas. If we look after women's emotional well-being, reduce their stress system, then all these hormones will flow much more easily, because stress turns labor down basically by a number of hormonal mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Now we need to also redesign all these labor rooms then.
Yes. Well, the simple thing that you can do as a laboring woman, as a birthing woman, is bring a doula. You know, have your own stress reducing system right there next to you, because, you know, having a doula does decrease your chance of all these interventions, because, you know, your hormones flow. That would be my hormonal physiology explanation of that. And a doula is someone that can protect your space. And sometimes I talk about animal birth in my lectures, and I talk about how some animals have lots of helpers around and some animals have just one, and some animals, like cats, go into a cupboard and give birth by themselves, and women are like that. But, you know, a doula can be like a circle of elephants that happens in elephant birth, protecting and supporting the laboring female. And in elephant world, the laboring woman's surrounded by a circle of elephant helpers, and they sway in time with the laboring mother and soothe her with their trunks, and also obviously form a formidable barrier, protective circle. So a doula can be that for you, your circle of elephants, to really give you that private space. And also taking a doula into hospital with you, you know, when you go into hospital, it's not really your space. It's an unfamiliar space for you, and it can be kind of hard to make it your own, whereas the doulas are much more familiar with that space, and, you know, they'll open the windows and put out your beanbags, mm-hmm. and, you know, just help you to really make it your own. And that's really important too, because, again, we're talking about the limbic system, that primitive part of the brain that's really tuned into sights and smells. I mean, smells are really important, so taking in familiar smells, your pillow you can burrow your head into, you know, all those sort of things are really helpful in labor and birth, and obviously having familiar people. So yeah, we do need to redesign labor and birth, definitely, and we need to think about hormonal physiology, and in the meantime, yes. Take your doula.
Yes, I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a room and just gone in and, you know, first thing, hit even at a client's house, I'll arrive and I'll turn down the lights or turn off the lights, and the response is, oh, that's so much better.
Yeah.
And it seems so simple, but it's being aware of, let's make this more cozy for you.
Yes, that's right. And as we talked about before, you know, labor and birth, the processes hormonally are very similar to making a baby. So what sort of conditions you need to have a baby and make a baby, as you say, dim lighting, you know, few words, no numbers, no shopping lists, you know, only people around that you feel safe with. So, you know, that's really quite a good rule of thumb. How can you make this into a lovemaking session? Because that's basically what's happening in labor. You're making oxytocin, the hormone of love, in this tremendous way. Actually, there's one more thing I want to mention about that, again, you probably will ring bells with you and with some of the listeners, is that oxytocin, what we discovered from animal studies, can be transmitted pheromonally. What that means is a hormone transmitted from one individual to another. And there's actually a rat study where they've got two rats in a cage, and they injected one with synthetic oxytocin into the brain, because remember, injecting it into the body doesn't give those central pain relieving effects. Mm-hmm. And then they could measure this rat and say, yes, it did have that pain relieving effect. But then they measured its cage mate, who wasn't administered synthetic oxytocin. And the cage mate also had those pain relieving effects. And they figured out that it's transmitted pheromonally through this organ in the nose called the vomeronasal organ. And, you know, in labor and birth, that's really true. If you're with a woman, if you're a doula or a midwife, it probably explains why you do what you do. Because when you're with a woman with these high levels of this euphoric, calming, connecting, loving hormone, then you feel it too. And particularly after birth, it's just a big love fest. The woman has these peak levels of oxytocin, and the father falls in love with the mother, and the mother falls in love with the baby, and the baby falls in love with the mother, and the mother falls in love with the midwife. I mean, just basically everybody falls in love with each other because of this pheromonal oxytocin going on. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's so great. Yeah, that's exactly why I do it.
The rewards at the end, isn't it? And that's, you know, that's exactly what mothers get too, of course. And I'm not saying that the processes of labor and birth are necessarily, you know, pain-free or, you know, calm and connecting. You don't necessarily feel that. I mean, it's a very incredibly intense experience, but it's a bit like what I was describing for the baby. You know, it's an intense, inevitably an intense experience for the baby. Inevitably, there's going to be strains to physiology, but there's this hormonal system that's designed to enfold that, to protect that, to optimize outcomes in the face of that. And, you know, the stresses of labor and birth and these hormonal elevations are essential for the next stage to happen, as we've talked about, that the baby does have this catecholamine surge to enact that transition to life outside the womb, that the mother does have these hormone peaks so that attachment is successful. And, you know, the other hormone we haven't talked about much that is in the report is cortisol, which is a stress hormone. But cortisol is also a hormone involved in romantic attachment. When I read that, I thought about when I was a teenager, I used to read those romantic fiction. They were called Mills and Boone at the time. And I thought, oh, that's it. You know, they always get the man and the woman in this stressful situation and then they fall in love out of it, you know. And that's what happens in labor and birth, that stress of labor and birth, and that the hormones and the cortisol helps mothers and babies to fall in love. And they've measured that. They've measured that the more cortisol a new mother has, the more attracted she is to her baby's scent. Yeah.
Mm. That one I hadn't heard. Mm. Very good. I'm taking notes and I'm going like, oh, this I didn't know. Fabulous.
Well, as I said, you can go to the report too, yes. Adriana, or anyone listening. And you know, if you want to search cortisol in the PDF bar, and you'll find all the mentions of that as well. And you can also think, well, I'm talking about something that happens after the birth in relation to the stress hormone, so I'm going to look at the stress hormone chapter, adrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and I'm going to look in the afterbirth section, which is that would be 5.1.4. So the chapters all the point one. So for example, oxytocin is chapter 3. So chapter 3.1 is oxytocin physiology, how it's designed to work. And so 3.1.1 is what we describe, you know, outside labor and birth. Point two is in pregnancy. Point three is in labor and birth. And point four is after the birth. And then the 3.2 is what happens with these various interventions that we talk about. So you can basically navigate your way around. It's very logically laid out. So yeah, you look in the adrenaline, epinephrine chapter. You look in point 1.4 of that chapter to find what's happening after the labor and birth in physiologic terms.
Because it's all connected. At the end, it's all connected.
It's all connected. That's it. And, you know, it's really a little arbitrary to even have to split it up like this, because all of these things are interconnected in ways that we don't understand. And sometimes it's a bit of a limitation of our scientific method. We only look at one thing in isolation, and yet it's a whole hormonal orchestra that we're talking about. And if one thing goes off, you know, it can really make other things go off. And you know, during labor and birth, these hormones interact in a phenomenal way, again, that we don't really understand. And you know, some of the interactions between hormones are quite unique to labor and birth as well. You know, the connections between them increase, between the hormonal systems increase in the lead up, so that they can have this orchestration effect in labor and birth.
Sarah, thank you so much for all that information and being so generous with your time. We could keep talking for hours and hours, but we'll have people go and take a look at the study, at the report instead.
Yeah, good that. Idea. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
If they wanted to continue following what you do and get in touch, how can they do that?
Oh, yeah. So go to my website, sarahbuckley.com, and look on the subscribe thing. And if you subscribe, you can subscribe as a birth professional, and you'll get the book Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor, which is a really great introduction to this material. As I said, I wrote it for Mothering Magazine and for 2002. I'm always updating it. So it's written for lay people. It's not written for professionals. It is quite detailed. There's also, if you sign up for parents, and you can certainly do both, the ebook is called Pain and Labor, Your Hormones Are Your Helpers, which is a very simple version of this material as well. So sign up for one, sign up for both, and you'll get in touch with all of my material. And I'm just right now working on finishing off a new membership program for pregnant women. I'm giving some of this information, a whole lot of other really great information as well. We're just finishing off the first trimester, the first 10-week program, and we'll be rolling out the other ones as well. So you'll get all the news about that. That should be coming up in the next month. We're working as hard as we can, but you'll get all the information about that when you sign up to my e-newsletters.
Fantastic. We'll be looking forward to it.
My pleasure.
Thanks again.
Okay. Thanks, Adriana. My pleasure.
Mighty Ones, find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, send me messages, and more. And if you want access to the ad-free episodes, along with the extra content companion handout that I've created for this episode, inspired by Sarah's suggestions on how to support your birth hormones, then you should join us over at the Birthful Patreon and become an official Birthful supporter. You can find out more at patreon.com/birthful. Now, if what you want to do is get ready for life with a newborn, then go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up for my Thrive With Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you, those amazing Birthful Patreon supporters, and the wonderful people at Swanky Badger and Molecule. Go to swankybadger.com/birthful to get 10% off your first purchase, and go to molecule.com and enter birthful at checkout for $75 off your first order. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin McLeod, and the sponsorship song is Air Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Also, the Birthful podcast is part of the Parents on Demand Network, a network of podcasts focused on parents. Download the free Parents on Demand app on Apple and Android for easy on-the-go listening. I'm Adriana Loseda. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to a mighty parent as they share their amazing story here at the Birthful podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This episode is copyright 2019 by Adriana Lozada.